This is Anyone Can Play Guitar, the podcast for musicians and music lovers that takes you behind the scenes of the music industry.
This week is brought to you in partnership with guitar rigs from NGR Music. Ever wondered what equipment your favourite guitarists used? Head over to ngrmusic.com/guitar rigs now for detailed pedal diagrams, amplifier and guitar combinations that define an era. Whether it's Kurt Cobain's 1991 setup or Alex Turner's from 2006, ngrmusic.com/guitar rigs is the place to go.
Welcome to episode 120 of the Anyone Can Play Guitar podcast with me, James, and him,
Ben. I went close that time this time. And you know what, James? I'm glad you done the intro on this one, because it's, as people probably know from the title, it's John Flansburgh from They Might Be Giants. If I was doing it, I think I would have went for some kind of They Might Be Giants pun from like Birdhouse in Your Soul, like use some kind of like line from that or something. I would have got it really bad, basically. I would have done a bad job.
We can thank our lucky stars that it fell the way it did.
Yes. Yes, we can.
We might be giants.
We might.
Talk to me about what's coming up, Ben.
Yes, well, They Might Be Giants are John and John. So there's a fair chance I was speaking to someone called John in this episode. I spoke to John Flansburgh, a fellow left-handed guitarist. Don't get many of those. It's nice to have like left-handed guitar representation.
You're like a little club, aren't you?
Yeah, well, it's a good club. Felix White from the Maccabees, Kurt Cobain, Paul McCartney, he did all right. And obviously there are many, but I'm not going to go through a massive list of left-handed.
I was glad. I didn't know where you were going to stop.
Anyway, thanks. I'll move off that now. But yes, I spoke to John about, They Might Be Giants have got an album coming out in just under 2 weeks called Book, which has an accompanying, if I can get that word right, book. And it is very good. As you know, I'm a fan of Bare Naked Ladies. And this album, along with a lot of They Might Be Giants stuff, reminds me of Bare Naked Ladies and that kind of world. It's a very good album. It's really good.
What number album is this for them?
Good question. This is album 22.
Wow.
Which includes 5 kids' albums. And then on top of that, they've got like a few mini albums. But as John says, they've nearly been going for 40 years. And I was like, that can't be right. I mean, John will know more than me about his career.
Well, yes, but, probably best not to question him on that point.
Yeah, but like a lot of people have spoke to this series, longevity, and we'll get onto that towards the end, about one of the main reasons longevity becomes a thing.
Season 3, the season of longevity.
I mean, we're on episode 120. That's a lot longer than I bet people thought it would go on.
Absolutely. So, but hey, people listening who are starting out in music and they want to, like, yes, you're not planning for album 20, but if you get some of the principles right from the get-go that a lot of these people we've been speaking to over the past sort of year, it's not a bad place to start.
That is very true. So we talk a little bit about writing and how that may have changed over time in this long career, playing live, starting to play live again. And just a good chat about music. So I think we should just dive right in.
Get in there.
Now, first, I should just preface it by saying, like, you know, everybody's had a terrible pandemic, so it's not like, I don't think we're in any way unique, we're embarking on a tour of the United States with 40 or 45 shows books,
right.
But the vast majority of which had already sold out, which was really the like a kind of a first in our career. I mean, we've been touring for 30 years plus, I guess. And we've done a couple of tours where most of the tours sell out by the time by the night of the show. And a lot of shows sell out in advance. But having a tour that had sold out months in advance was a kind of a phenomenon that was really notable to us and very exciting. And then basically, you know, COVID hit and everything got shut down, and we've actually had to reschedule the shows. I think we're on the third rescheduling now. So it's such an adult portion of dreariness. That's the way it's been. We're just rolling with it. We just want to make sure everybody's actually safe, including ourselves. So, yeah.
So when are you due to play your first gig then?
I think in March of next year. So hopefully everyone will have convinced their media siloed crazy uncle who watches, you know, crypto fascist TV and radio to get the jab and get over themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we are starting some kind of, I think it's already started some kind of booster at the moment,
to try and get us
through the winter. But that's quite nice to know that it's coming, that the dates are, they're on their way, that they're going to happen, hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, it would be, honestly, it would be, if we had to actually cancel something, I think it could be put us in a very precarious situation. We've only canceled like a handful of gigs in our entire career. And it took so long what sort of burned in my memory as a gigging musician is like we had a show that was sold out that in Nashville that we canceled the night before when we had our equipment truck got stolen in the middle. We basically woke up. We thought we were flying out to Nashville and the equipment truck was going to catch up with us.
Mm-hmm.
And instead the equipment truck had been absconded with, and we had to cancel the show. And it basically, I think the rest for the next 20 years, we've been just trying to claw our way back to that level of success in Nashville.
Right.
I mean, canceling a gig, no audience person wants to repeat that ever. It's like irradiates your draw as a live band. I mean, I guess if you made your reputation on being unreliable, maybe it would add some allure, like people would save the ticket or something. But
yeah,
for a band like us, it's just like, it turns out those guys are a drag.
Yeah, yeah, I bet. Cool. Well, if we dive now into the five songs that hopefully will help people who are on their own musical quest, journey, whatever you want to call it. But I think a good place to start is this is the song for you from your career that started everything. Now, you can answer this any which way you want. It could be the first song you ever released. It could be the first song you ever wrote. Or it could be the first song that one of your friends or yourself thought, actually, you know what? This is pretty good. And I think we've got something here. So it started everything in motion to start your career.
Oh wow! Well, let me scan my thinking, and my life history. Well, there was a song on our second album called Cowtown that was actually the first song that John and I did in They Might Be Giants, and in some ways, it's kind of a modest song. It's not some chart bound track. It's just kind of an odd little country number, but it really was the thing that we sort of dug in on first. And it's got a lot of the kind of contrary motion that They Might Be Giants songs have. Although it is essentially in a kind of country idiom, it has all these hard left turns and weird instrumental breaks. And that is very kind of, They Might Be Giants-y, I guess. It didn't seem like that big a eureka moment at the time, but it really was the first thing. I mean, I remember the songs, the cover songs we played just for fun back then. And, cause we just didn't have that many original songs, which is, seems very odd considering how many songs we've written since then. But yeah, we would do like, we did all these songs from sort of the early 60s, like that in between period between like roots rock and roll. And then, and when the Beatles arrived, we did like, we did Leslie Gore songs and we did some Tommy Rowe songs. These are all like the kind of people that like Bob Dylan will reference in his book. Oh, yeah. You know, these sort of these people who, you know, that it's like one click beyond most people's collective memories of, you know, maybe it gets played on oldies radio, but that was, I don't know. We were into it though. I mean, we were into the songs.
Yeah. So as you've just mentioned there, you've obviously got lots and lots of songs written. What I've got is 22 albums, including 5 kids albums at the moment. That's quite a body of work. How has that moment changed? I mean, the answer might be it hasn't, but how has that moment changed that when you write a new album, something like Book that's coming out next month, how has that moment changed when you know actually we've got something? We know that we have got the germ or the genesis of a new album or a new project.
Well, you know, we break it off into easier pieces. I mean, I think we really think of the song as the device that we're working with, and albums are kind of collected as we go along.
Right.
And you know, I think we have some good habits and some bad habits in terms of that kind of stuff. We can, in the middle of arranging a song, we can reshuffle the whole thing to make it more effective. And that's a good impulse. I think I feel like you even hear this in interviews with people that like the only thing that they feel like they trust is their first impulse. And, you know, not just, I mean, this might just seem simply contrarian, but I don't think it really is. I think there's actually more that can be done besides having one good original idea. Like you can actually take things further if you really look at stuff from more than one direction. And I think it, that might happen because that original spark of writing a song is, you know, doesn't come every minute of the day. But still, you know, you just think about how, I mean, songwriting is kind of a craft thing. It's not, once you're off to the races, it can be pretty durable and it can be pushed around in a bunch of ways that make it more effective. And I think there's nothing wrong with trying to figure out how to take something to the next level.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point. Well, actually that's a nice segue to the second song, which is the song that we like to focus on. The second one is the song that changed everything. So that's the song that started everything. What's the song that changed everything? Now this could be the first song that got on the radio. It could be the first song that really climbed up the charts. Obviously, it could be one that sold lots of albums. It could be anything. But what's the one that made it change from, we've got a couple of albums out here to,
sure,
Now we're a touring band making money. This is our career.
Sure. It was relatively easy. I mean, it almost feels like it should be a split decision because there were two songs that went through the kind of similar process. We made a no budget video with Adam Bernstein for the song Puppet Head, which was on a demo we made that got reviewed by People magazine. And that really took us from being a local band in New York, albeit a band coming up in New York when the local scene in New York was being very, very closely watched. I mean, that was, the fact that there was a really healthy club music scene in New York City was the reason that our demo got reviewed. It wasn't just us. It was like there was a world of things happening. But I guess ultimately the song that really, we probably would have gone on the road and done, we, at the very end of like 85, beginning of 86, we got a tour manager. We got a booking agent who's still our booking agent to this very day. And but he's a big wheel in the world of booking agents. His name is Frank Riley. He books like half the bands you know. And right. So it was like, it was kind of like, you know, meeting the godfather of rock touring. And he was skeptical that we really had the grit to, you know, hit the road in the way that he was going to put us on the road. Cause we were doing like seven shows a week, in a lot of places that, you know, could be broadly defined as dumps. But what really changed was in the midst of this activity, we did a second video with Adam Bernstein called, Don't Let's Start, and we had a budget of like $2,000 instead. So there's an actual crew there, and it was shot on film, which made it look really stand out from what was on MTV at the time. MTV was relatively new, and it was still in that very sweaty video period. Our video had much more of kind of like a Hard Day's Night feel to it. Like it had this warm, vaguely cinematic look, as well as having like very crazy imagery. I mean, maybe it looked more like a Fellini movie than a Hard Day's Night, but it looked like a movie. I guess is really the key thing, because it was just shot on like 16mm in black and white, and there were strange impulses and a kind of a nice aesthetic. So it really cut through what was on MTV. And that just brought people out. I mean, all of a sudden we were really on the scene with a song that was considered a sort of a viable radio song.
Right. And how did you deal with that change? Because obviously,
it just went from being a drag to being okay. It wasn't like we were buying big cars.
Okay. But so did that give you a bit more inspiration and hunger to keep on going and do more? And did it change your writing at all? Did it change the way you approached everything?
In a sense, I mean, I think the life experience that changed our approach between the first, we made, you know, like all bands, we made our first album kind of in a bit of a void. We were playing clubs, but there was something kind of hypothetical about the musical universe we were residing in when we were playing at these performance art clubs in New York City. By the time we did our second album, I think we already had sensed the utility of up-tempo songs and rock songs in the show. Like experience with live performance kind of turns everyone into, it turns you around as a performer because all of a sudden, all the things that everybody else might know and tell you about makes complete sense. You know, things that sounded jaded before suddenly seem just like, oh, that's good advice. It's very easy to lose an audience. It's very easy to have a show that has no dynamics to it. And I think we knew that we had to win the audiences over with our live show. And we poured a lot of our energy into keeping things going live. And that was the thing that rubbed off on the songwriting. It wasn't so much like, oh, we have to write another radio-ready song, so much as we have to keep what we're doing kind of ultra vivid.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a nice segue again into track three, which is, what is your favorite song to play live? Now, if you want to, you can choose someone else's if you want to do a cover, but if you want to pick one of your own, that's probably best.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to think, you know, it's hard to say what makes something a favorite. I'm not like a high fidelity person who keeps like long lists of things in order of how much I like them.
Yeah.
Some songs just seem like a vacation from the concentration you need to work. We do a song from our first album called Number Three, where John and I are just singing. And that is very pleasant to just sing and not sing and play. Not that singing and playing necessarily is such a big ask, but I have to say, it's like nothing to sing a song that you've sung a million times. And that's very pleasant. Playing the song Don't Let's Start live actually for me is super fun because it's kind of a string of pearls, as some musicians say. Like the guitar part of it is very linear. So it just kind of goes from one fun little part to another, and it changes around a lot over the course of the song. So it's super short. So it's just this kind of high energy blast, and people are always surprised when we still play it.
Especially for like the hardcore fans as well, I guess.
Yeah.
So if you had to describe a They Might Be Giants gig show to someone who hasn't seen it before, how would you describe it?
Well, it's changed over time. You know, I mean, we've gotten impossibly old. We've been doing this for like almost 40 years now. I wonder what it'll be like to go back. It's a lot of fun. You know, we have a great live band and we work pretty in a pretty focused way to keep the song selection evolving, in part to make sure that the show we present is quite different from the previous show we presented in that town. Like we'll whatever show it is, whenever it is, half the repertoire will be pretty different. So if you came to a previous show, you won't see the same show. And that I think is a meaningful thing, but maybe even more kind of spiritually meaningful is that by keeping so many songs in rotation as a live band, we keep the show interesting and challenging to ourselves. And I think that is maybe that's ultimately like kind of the secret sauce. And not that people need to know that the band is working hard, but I think by working hard at keeping the repertoire moving, keeps us interested and challenged by what we're doing live. And that's real. I've read more than one review of really high quality bands kind of having their moment and embarking on what probably inevitably will be the longest international touring of their career. They start a show in their hometown and they've got their very strong musical effort to present. And it's a very exciting and engaging show. And then 6 months later, they return from, you know, wherever far flung places they've been, and they're doing the exact same show. And it's like they've been, you know, sentenced to, you know, to life in prison. You know, and that's such a familiar scenario. And I feel like it is avoidable, but you really have to be up for rehearsing and sound checks and doing all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, of course. Well, actually, that leads us to the next question, song four. Now, this is probably going to be the trickiest one because obviously you've got such a big body of work. But what is your hidden gem of a track? The one that I don't know why you think it's the best song you've ever written or your favorite song. I know you don't keep lists, but, or, or one that you means a lot, and then maybe it's a B-side, maybe it's track 8 on some album, I don't know. So what would you say is your hidden gem that you wish maybe more people liked?
Oh, well, I mean, this is, I could vote a couple of different ways with that. I think a track like Fingertips, which is this sort of parade of musical fragments, okay, might be my personal favorite. I think it's a fan favorite as well, because it's just such a crazy piece of music. It seems uniquely, singularly a They Might Be Giants kind of idea for a song. And it's fun to play. And it's just not like any other, it's just nothing any other band would do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. And like, and how good are you at, so if you've got all writing all these songs and you've got such a big body of work, how good are you at ditching songs when you know something's not working or that you're not happy with it? Do you keep on working at it, or you thought, nope, let's just start again with something new?
Well, I think songs probably don't get that far in the band if they're, and the good part is usually pretty extractable. Is that the word? Mm-hmm. From the bad part. We've taken song titles from songs that were sort of half written and then just started again in on a different song. If the song title seems intriguing, but the way the song is coming together is not. I think we might be so brutal with that kind of process that we don't even think of it at, we don't even think of those unfinished or half finished projects as like, they're just what's happened on the way to actually finishing something.
Yeah. Cool. Well,
you gotta be rigorous with materials, I guess, that's what my art teacher would say.
Yeah. Good point. Okay, so the last song there, because I'm just a bit conscious of time there, the legacy track. What song do you think would be remembered for the most?
Well, in the UK, it would be Birdhouse in Your Soul, which is like the only song that really broke through in a big way there for us. Right. In the US, probably the same. But, we recorded the theme to The Daily Show, which is something that it seems like it was a big hit show in the United States. And I don't think a lot of people in the U.S., everyone knows the tune, which was written by Bob Mould of Husker Du, but I don't think anybody knows we're the people performing it. So it's kind of like our little cultural Trojan horse that went out into the world. Mm-hmm. And of course the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, they didn't really have any credits per se. It all just flew by. So, I think that's probably the thing. Well, maybe it's the thing it's the most well-known thing that we are least known for, put it that way.
Okay. Yeah. That's good to get your head around that one. Yeah. As this is the legacy track, what's the main bit of advice you would give to someone who's either starting out, getting a bit stuck, or just kind of maybe they are pushing on to the next level in their career? Because you've obviously had a long career with lots of input into the world of music. What would be your main advice to someone?
At the risk of sounding like an out-of-work actor, I would just say yes. We've done a lot of things on emerging formats that make us seem like we knew what the future was going to be, but we also did a lot of things on emerging formats that never took off. So we just if there were opportunities to work. We just jump for them. I don't know. I think people are also afraid that their ideas are going to be stolen too much. You know, inevitably, if you do some kind of songwriting conference, people are like, I want, you know, they're very calculating. Young songwriters are often very calculating and try to hide their stuff away. And I think back on our career and how much stuff we had out in the world before it was ever on a record and or before there was ever any of, you know, any publicly available for sale recording of it. And it just didn't matter. It helped having more stuff in the world. And, you know, I just think being in the mix is really what it's all about.
Yeah. Well, that's a great way to end it, is being in the mix, not saying no. And just, we've heard that a lot, actually.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Just say yes, because you don't know what it's going to lead to.
And exactly.
Longevity, James. And another true word has been said. It's been said before in a couple of episodes. Just saying yes to things. Just like, if someone offers you something, let's just see where it goes.
And that was point. I'm going to do a blog post or something on the common themes that are coming out of now that we've done 120 episodes, because there's quite a few. And if I've learned anything from Sherlock Holmes, Ben, there's no such thing as coincidence.
I mean, very good. Yes, there is no such thing as coincidences.
And so I think it's only right that we shine the light on these things that keep cropping up, because clearly people who have been in the music game for a hell of a long time all do or talk about very similar things repeatedly. So, you know, it's not like there's a magic formula, but clearly if you do certain things, you're kind of increasing your chances.
That's right. And let's be honest, the Coldplays, U2s, REMs, Oasis of this world, your stadium bands, they don't come down very often. But if you take your chances and say yes to a lot of things, you could have a 40-odd year career like John, which, let's be honest, it's not having a 40-odd career in ...
I imagine the majority of people listening, ourselves included, you're not going to sniff at a career that long in music at all.
Travel the world X amount of times over. Do 22 albums. I mean, and as you mentioned about Birdhouse in Your Soul, the legacy track, like, even you've got like a handful of those songs that kind of broke through into the music consciousness. That's a lot more than people get. A lot of people get. So,
oh yeah, but when you've written that many songs on that many albums, there's going to be some of them that are going to break through.
Exactly. And theme tune of Malcolm in the Middle. That would have been a different show. The theme tune for Malcolm in the Middle. And then, as he's also mentioned, the theme tune for The Daily Show, which was a stealth. Not many people know it was them. They think it was someone else. I mean, that's a lot of ears here in those songs.
Certainly is. Yeah. So yes, Ben, before you go and put your teeth in so you can talk, who's coming up next time?
Well, before that, thank you to John for speaking to us, and thank you for Terry for setting up the interview.